we in a position where the government and indeed the EU European Commission literally give taxpayer money to lobby themselves?
Yeah, it's insane.
Like, how does that even happen?
It's the most IEA conversation I think we've ever had. Trickle down economics. Okay, I should be grateful. Peter Hitchens isn't writing enough articles about Lucy Letby. So I had to turn to Grok to create one for me. Letby's plight, daylight saving, and cannabis are bound by a common thread, an unshakable faith in flawed systems and seductive narratives.
Hello and welcome back to Last Orders. I'm Tom Slater. Chris Snowden is here. Hello, Chris.
It's me. I'm back again.
He is. Also back again is Reem Ibrahim from the IEA. How are you doing, Reem?
Hello, I'm very well. How are you?
I'm very well. We've got a lot to talk about today. We're going to talk trade deals. We're going to talk the Nanny State Index, which you've just launched over at the IEA, as well as the latest on the Nanny State blob and whether or not they can be defunded. Before we do that, I just want to remind everyone about our very special event that we've got coming up in a couple of weeks' time in Westminster on Wednesday, the 28th of May. Andrew Doyle will be joining me on stage to discuss his brilliant new book, The End of Woke. This event is exclusively for Spike supporters, those who donate money to us every month. So if you're already a supporter, go over to the website now, log in, and you can buy your ticket. If you're not already a supporter, now is surely the right time to sign up. You can come to this event, you can come to future events, you can comment on the articles and all sorts of other perks. So to find out more about that, go to spiked-online.com/supporters. So let's kick off and talk about a series of trade deals that the British government have struck in the past couple of weeks. One very comprehensive, I think it's fair to say, with India, which proved to be quite controversial within various sections of politics. And also a lot less comprehensive one, Reem, with the US. Should we start with India? Because that's one that's really has proven even more controversial, strangely. So do you want to tell us a little bit more about what was in it and what people seem to be objecting
yes.
to?
Yes. So it is really interesting. It's obviously not entirely comprehensive in that, you know, a real comprehensive trade deal from my radical perspective would be a complete reduction in every single tariff to zero. But we don't live in libertarian cuckoo land, unfortunately. What I find interesting about it is effectively for products like whiskey, for some cosmetics, for medical supplies, we've got pretty free trade. So we're now reducing tariffs and quotas between the UK and India. So overall, it's a pretty good trade deal. It will probably only, the government have estimated about 0.1% difference in GDP for the UK. So probably not that much, but it will be interesting, especially when it comes to things like the labour market. Now, this has sparked up quite the controversy, especially amongst various different right-wing spaces, where a lot of people are saying that the fact that Indian workers from Indian companies that are temporarily going to be in the UK will be allowed a national insurance contribution exemption. Now, the reason for that is because they won't have access to the NHS or any other social services. They won't be retiring in the UK, so they won't get a state pension. And so they will not have access to any of those services and so not pay a social security tax. Now, I think what this whole thing has actually really revealed is that national insurance contributions are actually just a massive scam because NIC does not directly pay for social security. It actually pays for various different things. And of course, through income tax and through other taxes, we are paying for the welfare state. So I think what it really did do is just highlight the absolute sham that is national insurance contributions.
And what do you think it revealed, particularly about the Conservative Party, that they felt the need to come out and criticise this measure, which as you say is quite standard part of many trade deals that we have with various countries, but they seem to be really desperate to be seen to be against it. I mean, are they kind of, I don't know, just game playing with this, and if that means trashing a free trade deal, they actually had quite a large hand in negotiating when they were still in government, then so be it.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. It kind of suggested that a lot of the criticism of the national insurance contribution exemption was actually like vibes based. It was, this feels wrong, this vibes wrong, rather than actually looking into any of the detail. Now, of course, I can understand a bit of the outrage, right? The feeling that an Indian worker might be more competitive than a British worker because they are not, the employers aren't required to pay national insurance. So of course it reduces the cost of that labor. But of course we know that that isn't the case in reality. These are all Indian workers for Indian companies that are being temporarily moved over here as a result of the trade deal. So overall, the trade deal is really, really great. And we can have a conversation about the NIC exemption, whether or not any company should be receiving it. But again, we've had this agreement with about 50 other countries already. So if you're outraged about this one, you've got to be outraged about the ones with the EU and Barbados and various other countries. So I do think it's interesting that it was effectively a vibes-based disagreement. And it seems as though Kemi Badenoch and the Conservative Party just wanted to get there first before Reform did and before Nigel Farage began to criticise it. Again, wasn't really that big of a deal. And if you're upset about this part of the trade deal, then you've got to be upset about a whole lot more.
Mm-hmm. And Chris, what did you make of this deal or the blow up about it?
I looked at it as I look at most pieces of news, insofar as I thought of ways I could weaponize it against my enemies.
Yeah, of course.
And so my take is this is obviously a big Brexit benefit.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore a hill I'm going to die on. I didn't know anything about this national insurance thing. I didn't know we had other trade deals in which this was a part of it.
But nor did a lot of people, it seems.
No,
like, so.
Well, you didn't know, did you? I found out within about 10 minutes.
Former Trade Minister Kemi Badenoch was a...
Yeah, right, yeah. So. I found out within about 10 minutes, well, okay, that's absolutely fair enough. And they're paying the NHS surcharge as well.
Mm.
So absolutely fine, got no problem with it. It's a good thing. It's great that we're slashing whiskey tariffs, although they're still really high.
Yeah.
Mm. I mean, the Indians drink a lot of whiskey. And it is pretty bad stuff. And it's partly because it's the tariff. I think the tariff was 100%.
Yeah.
And it's come down to 25 or something like that. It's still actually quite a high tariff. But it's great for, the Scotch whiskey industry. It's definitely a step forward. It is a Brexit benefit. I think even James O'Brien had to admit it was a Brexit benefit.
Oh, really?
Which is incredible. It must have
been
a rare
moment of.
Must have really hurt him. But, people will always. With any trade deal, people can always criticise it, because if you're not criticising a lack of trade deal because customers are paying too high a price, you're criticising the trade deal because what about the farmers?
Mm-hmm.
Or what about such and such a thing? And it's interesting to see people, depending on their political allegiance, switch between either of those arguments.
Yeah.
And you can do quite, kind of justifiably. Obviously, me and Reem would be much more interested in consumers getting a decent price than we are protecting industries. But there is a kind of a yin and yang to it. And people will use either of those arguments depending on what they think. So people who are very, very anti-Brexit will be going, what about the farmers? And what about whichever industry supposedly...
Because they didn't care about the farmers before Brexit. I mean, they'll weaponise the protectionist argument, I think, for particular political aims. And what I found really, really disappointing, actually, from the entirety of the right, except for a couple of organisations. I know that Michael Simmons at The Spectator was very much like, no, this isn't a big deal. And the free trade agreement is a really, really good thing. But I want to think I found really, really fascinating is that this huge misconception that trade is only good for us when we're exporting things. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, was really, really interesting, because fundamentally one of the basic principles of free trade is that we're able to import goods from across the world that are produced more cheaply. India, of course, have a huge comparative advantage in the fact that they have really low labour costs. So we'll be able to import so many cheap goods from across the world. And now with India, we're able to achieve that. And people are still saying it's a bad thing that we're not going to be exporting as much as India is importing. It's kind of like the Trump vibe with the trade deficit stuff. I mean, it's just complete economic nonsense.
Yeah, but very persistent. It's mercantilism, basically.
Yeah.
And this balance of payment stuff and all these kind of old, stuff that, like, the very, very earliest economists debunked it. Ricardo and Smith, 250 years ago, this was one of the first things they said, like, a lot of people think this, but if you really think about it properly, it's not true. And still, it's not just persisting. I would say it's growing. Weird kind of economic nationalism is back, and it's a bad thing for free marketeers.
And while we're on economic nationalism, while we've mentioned Trump, Reem, is there anything that we should draw from this US-UK deal? It's a lot thinner than the Indian one. Obviously, Trump has been hailing it as the best deal since sliced bread. But, what should we really make of it? Not least because the prospects of a US trade deal have taken on kind of nightmarish proportions in a lot of sort of liberals' heads. So are we going to all be, eating and dying from our chlorinated chicken whilst Elon Musk purchases the NHS? Is that what's in store for us, or is something else happening?
Well, unfortunately not. You're absolutely right, Tom. I mean, it definitely wasn't as comprehensive as the UK-India trade deal, though I think comprehensive might be a bit of an exaggeration. Anyway, we got steel and aluminium tariffs reduced from 25% to nothing. So what I think was interesting about that is we don't really export a lot of steel and aluminium to the US anyway. Car trade is interesting because the reductions in tariffs only apply to 100,000 cars. Last year, we exported 92,000 to the US. Mm-hmm. So again, literally nothing, and it probably will not make much of a difference in the long term anyway. And there are some, there are some real missing parts to this. Pharmaceuticals. You actually mentioned chlorinated chicken. Of course, there was a reduction tariff with beef exports. It will be a good thing for us. I mean, it means we'll be able to get American beef, which is much more cheaply produced again. But what's interesting is that there seems to have been a shift in the Trump administration. The guy that basically the architect of Liberation Day mm-hmm. was not there in the Oval Office when the trade deal was being announced. The language seems to have shifted. I mean, Trump was saying only a couple of months ago, I think, that, you know, children don't need 250 pencils, they can just have 5. Mm. You know, talking about, you know, restricting the way in which people access goods. But then when he was announcing the trade deal, a lot of the language had changed. He was talking about abundance and choice. So whilst materially there isn't that difference, it does seem as though there is a bit of a shift in the language, at least, that's being used by the Trump administration. Of course, the reality is that the trade agreement will probably not, you know, it's a sort of starting point, and they did kind of admit that. Oxford Economics didn't upgrade their growth forecasts at all as a result of the trade deal. Mm. So I think that's rather telling. Again, both trade deals are not going to be huge in terms of the amount that they'll have an impact on us specifically, but the politics of it, I think, is really interesting.
No, absolutely. I had one interesting speculation as well, was that because RFK is in place at their Department of Health, that might neutralise the whole chlorinated chicken and hormone-treated beef thing, because he's obviously a health freak and thinks all these things are terrible.
Asim Malhotra is now involved in Make America Healthy
Again. I saw
that.
Our old friend Asim Malhotra.
The
Yeah.
Asim Malhotra, incredible.
Well, there's nothing wrong with chlorinated chicken. Like chlorinated
I was told with great certainty by many people for many years after the Brexit referendum that we would absolutely not get a trade deal with America unless we accepted chlorinated chicken.
Yeah, so that was
How
the thing.
How could these people be wrong? It was,
yeah. They've been right about everything
can't
else.
Believe. So, yeah, Ian Dunn called it wrong again.
It was chlorinated chicken and the digital services tax. Those were the two things
and
that...
And hormone-grown beef. Mm.
Yeah, well, yeah. And a hormone-grown beef. These were the things that everybody said, we will never negotiate a trade deal with the US unless we
Absolute
accept chlorinated chicken
America.
And we reduce or get rid of our digital services tax, which, of course, hurts a lot of American tech companies. And yeah, you're right, none of those two things happened, and yet we got a free trade agreement with the US. I think the reason for that
is the British accent.
It is.
That seems in large part.
Charming. That's
he
why.
Kept it in the press conference. He was again talking about how nice Starmer's and Mandelson's voices were.
Oh, really?
So I think this is a significant part of this. You know, I'm not.
Didn't he say that Mandelson was handsome as well?
Did he?
Did he say you're a handsome guy or something?
I remember him saying he likes his accent. You've got a beautiful voice.
Beautiful voice, beautiful face. But sorry, you were saying.
Who would have thought there'd ever be a day when Peter Mandelson was an asset?
Yeah, exactly. For his charm and beauty. Yeah, there you go.
For his charm and good looks and his beautiful voice. Maybe you should get him in the podcast.
We should. Oh, that would be a hell of a get. And if we managed to get an interview with Peter Mandelson, of course, we would do it right here on Last Orders to find out what he thinks about Lucy Letby and all those things. But we should probably start moving on, actually. Chris, there has been a big project that the IEA have been running for a number of years now called the Nanny State Index. Mm. Its latest edition is out. So looking across Europe, where are the worst countries for consumer freedoms, for smoking, drinking, and so on? What's the league table
what's
looking
the score?
Like this year?
Pop pickers. Well, at number one, Turkey. Again, number two, I think is Lithuania. Well, it is Lithuania. And then you got like Finland and Hungary and Ireland in there in the top five. UK is seventh. Last time it was 11th. It's going up, and it's going up rapidly. In 2 years' time, next time I do it, it will be almost certainly top five, if not top three, I would think. There is just such a huge pipeline of stuff coming down the tracks. 2 weeks' time, we got the disposable vape ban, for example. Next year, we've got the vape tax. Year after that, we've got generational tobacco ban. In between then, we've got junk food advertising ban, and yeah, it's just a whole load of stuff. I'm having to create new categories just for the UK now. Mm. Literally in the 90-day index, because we are pioneers.
Yep.
And down towards the bottom, it's the usual countries, actually. Germany, yet again, is the relatively freest country in the list of 29. Luxembourg's there, Italy's there. All quite nice places, aren't they? You know, I'm not having a go necessarily at, you know, Lithuania and Turkey and Hungary, but I'd rather be in Luxembourg or Italy. On balance, they don't seem to be suffering from having not that much nanny state regulation. So, check it out, folks. Check out the website, nannystateindex.org. Includes lots of editorialising by me. Action on Smoking Health, proudly tweeted or posted on Blue Sky, whatever you call it, on Blue Sky. The Nanny State Index has shown that the UK is number one for tobacco. And they're very proud of that, as it should be. It's largely down to them.
Absolutely. Big achievement
we've got there. So I'm glad they're happy. So yeah, it's there. It's all the data is there. I mean, that's the thing about the United States Index. You can read it both ways. I mean, the information in it, the league tables themselves are basically quite neutral.
Mm-hmm.
We call it the Nanny State Index, which is not neutral. It's pejorative, and you know, rightly so. But the actual data in there, if you like the Nanny State, then you can look at it and go, yeah, well, Germany sounds awful.
Germany's not too free for them. The most interesting part, I think, about the Nanny State Index is the graphs at the beginning where you look at life expectancy and the comparisons between the Nanny State Index scores. So the entire intention behind Nanny State policies, lifestyle regulation, mm-hmm. things like alcohol minimum pricing or tobacco taxes, the entire purpose is to improve public health, or so they say. But there is absolutely no difference and no correlation between the higher you are on the Nanny State Index and life expectancy.
Or individual things like smoking rate and tobacco score and alcohol consumption. I haven't done obesity, but I'm pretty sure there wouldn't be a correlation there either. And there never has been.
Mm-hmm.
When we first started doing it and there was no correlation, one or two people said, well, maybe the countries that have the most Nanny State policies have them because they've got the biggest problem with X, Y, and Z. But after, you know, 9 years later, there's still no correlation. And, you know, obviously countries do move around a little bit in the league table. It never makes a difference. There's never been a hint of a correlation.
It's incredible that doesn't stop them. When we do, and if, say, hopefully, if we do, you know, maybe there's time to avert this, but when the generational smoking ban comes in, does that mean we're basically just top of the table after that point? Because surely no other country in the world has attempted
this. We're already top of the table for tobacco with about 90 points out of 100. So there isn't that much further to go. I genuinely don't know what kind of score to give for the generational tobacco ban. Because it is prohibition, but only prohibition in sort of 100 years' time.
Yeah.
In the first year of it, it's only going to be a very small number of people affected. So do I just give it a big score because it is prohibition, or do I give it a bigger score every 2 years? I don't know.
I think you'll
cross that bridge when we get to it.
Big score, I think.
I'm hoping someone might take over before then, to be honest with you. I'm sick of doing it.
It's
a really boring job.
This is the sixth one.
Because we used to do a free speech league table for universities.
It's hard
and
work,
that was a hell of a lot of work. Yeah. We gave up after four.
Yeah, we're gathering the data. We get a lot. To be fair, we get a lot of help from our partners around Europe, I should say. And without them, I just wouldn't do it at all.
Mm-hmm.
But it's mind-numbingly boring to do. So I hope people appreciate it and go.
But the report isn't mind-numbingly boring. It's
scintillating.
Plenty of insights, particularly for people who like this podcast.
And what are, again, where there is correlation between life expectancy.
Thank you, Remy. You got all the bullet points.
I know. You can tell I did the press release and the comms for this paper, don't you?
Doing a better job at selling these leads.
It's mind-numbingly boring.
That's why he's the author and I do the comms. Is economic growth. If you want to improve public health, grow the economy. That's
simple.
It.
Simple suggestion for all of those different countries. Chris, you wanted to talk about the Nanny State blob and the attempts.
Good
to,
news at last.
Exactly. It's sort of defunding the Nanny State story. Do you want to tell us a bit more about this?
I would love to. Because it hasn't been very widely reported. It's European Union Brussels type news, really. Politico have reported it with tears in their eyes, you can tell. But the gist of it is that there's been a kind of ongoing, more or less a scandal really in Brussels about the amount of money that's being given to NGOs, specifically to lobby. And not just in like, you know, we give them money and we can't stop them maybe lobbying with it, but they're not supposed to. But actually in the contract, you will lobby, you know, you will lobby MEPs with this money from the European Commission, signed the European Commission, right? So it's pretty blatant. It's been blatant for years. I wrote about this in 2013 in a paper called Euro Puppets, how the European Commission is remaking civil society, looking at the vast sums of money that's being given to all sorts of activist groups of all sorts of different, you know, for all sorts of different causes. And I never thought anything would be done about it. I'm not claiming any credit at all that something finally has been done about it. Apparently, according to Politico, it's because there's lots of right wingers in the parliament these days. And apparently this form of, yeah, corruption is only opposed by the right wing.
Exclusively.
Or even the far right, I think they've even suggested. So there was a few weeks ago a move by the European Commission to ban environmental NGOs from lobbying with Commission money. Which you might think, well, how was it ever allowed? You know, it's just insane, really. They all kicked off about it and said, this is how democracy dies, usual kind of thing. You know, we are civil society and politics can't live without us. And then last week, they did the same thing with the public health NGOs. which is superb news. They'll find ways around it. It won't stop the money completely, of course, but at least it sets a marker out, doesn't it? Saying this is wrong.
What kind of NGOs is it?
There are loads of them at EU level. You get ones that are kind of just generally nanny state issues, all sorts of nanny state issues in general. Like the main one is the European Public Health Alliance, which gets best part of €1 million from the European Commission. Was plagued with scandal actually last year.
What?
Yeah, yeah.
That's insane.
No, that's not even a big amount of money for some of these NGOs.
That's insane.
Some of them get millions and millions of euros. Yeah. So they're a particularly pernicious nanny state one. Go after anything, you know, food, alcohol, tobacco, vaping. Was riven with backfiting. Backbiting. What's the word? They apparently had a really toxic workplace, and all the staff were leaving. That was the last time I read about it in Politico. It was falling apart anyway. So they haven't got the money. There'll be various, anti-smoking ones. The European Smoke-Free Alliance, or something it's called. There'll be a load of temperance ones, which is good. There's one called Eurocare, which is really just a front for the gospel temperance lobby. Like, literally, you can trace it back to the 19th century temperance movement, but they call it Eurocare because it just sounds bland. You know? So it should have a positive effect. It's certainly good that they're saying at least that this is wrong. And the same thing was kind of achieved in Britain, for which I will take a little bit of credit, actually, because the government did give the IA credit at the time for my sock puppets research. You still get a lot of state-funded pressure groups in Britain.
Well, Action Smoking Health does.
Yeah, they still get it, but they get a fraction of what they used to.
And I think some of the, to be fair to them, I think some of the taxpayer money they do receive is specifically for stop smoking services and not necessarily for lobbying.
They don't provide any stop smoking services.
Oh, do they not?
I don't know how they get away with it, honestly. But there used to be a lot more organisations like that getting taxpayers' cash, and now, thanks to the anti-sock puppet clause, they don't. But there are various kind of loopholes, so the Scottish government keep doing it, the Welsh government keep doing it, and they really do in a big way, and local authorities can also do it. Even though local authorities literally cannot fix potholes, they will still give money to people to go out and protest the Coca-Cola truck coming to town. I'm not even exaggerating.
That's an actual example.
Exactly. Yeah.
So that's incredible.
How are we in a position where the government and indeed the EU European Commission literally give taxpayer money to lobby themselves?
Yeah, it's insane.
Like, how does that even happen?
Corruption. Years and years of rotten government.
I can't believe this.
So is there any prospects for something like that here, Chris? You said that a lot of the sock puppetry has been clamped down on to a degree over the years, but there's still plenty of it in all the places that you're talking about.
Well, it won't happen in Scotland and Wales because the governments are really like being lobbied by people that
are employed
by like-minded people. Yeah. I think probably the government could ban it at the local level, I guess. I don't know. There's really actually not that much of it, I have to say. Mm-hmm. It's not actually that big a deal. It's annoying that Ash still get the money, but they get a lot more now from their supporting charities. Cancer Research and British Heart Foundation. So, if you want to defund
bastards,
Ash, do not give money to Cancer Research or British Heart Foundation.
Good job.
It to Macmillan Cancer Research, who actually do a lot of good work, and I don't think do fund any activist groups.
There you go. Practical.
Or give it to the IA. Just give it to the IA.
Exactly.
It's spiked. It's takes donations, and you can become a Spite supporter and come to that event that I was telling you about.
Yeah, earlier on. We're a registered charity, so you get.
Oh, that's fair enough.
You get gift aid.
Yeah,
yeah. But who wants to? You know, they've got all this dark money flowing through them. We've got nothing. So
we definitely have. I need a pay rise.
Exactly. It's not reaching the foot soldiers. So before we get on to the post bag, Chris, shall we turn to Lucy Letby Corner?
Lucy Letby Corner. Ah.
I understand there's not much news that's developed, but
no.
I know you've been playing around with Grok, as you always do, and you've come up with an article that might shine some light on this issue as well as some others. Do you want to tell us
a lot of people are saying that Peter Hitchens isn't writing enough articles about Lucy Letby.
Mm.
So I had to turn to Grok to create one for me. I asked it to do an article in the style of Peter Hitchens about Lucy Letby, daylight saving time, and cannabis. And this is what it's come up with. Lucy Letby, daylight saving time, and cannabis. A Civilization Unraveling by Peter Hitchens. The case of Lucy Letby, branded a murderer of 7 infants and attempted killer of 6 more, is a stark warning of a society too swift to condemn. I am not persuaded of her guilt. The evidence, circumstantial, resting on contested medical claims, and statistical sleight of hand, fall short of the certainty such charges demand. Yet the public, whipped into frenzy by a rabid press, has already hanged her in his mind. This rush to judgment parallels two other modern absurdities, daylight saving time and the reckless normalization of cannabis, both emblems of a culture that prizes illusion over truth. Laibee's conviction hinges on flimsy grounds, a rota showing her presence at the deaths, correlation, not causation, a single disputed insulin test, an expert testimony divided on whether the infant's collapses were unnatural. The neonatal's unit's dire state, understaffed, plagued by poor hygiene, was brushed aside, as if one nurse could embody all evil. The Crown Prosecution Service's call for silence during her retrial stifles debate on a case it screams for. I fear a grave injustice, driven by a society desperate for a villain to mask its institutional failure. Daylight saving time, that biannual assault on our natural clocks, exposes the same folly. Each spring, we sacrifice sleep and sanity for no meaningful gain. A 2019 sleep medicine study linked the shift to a 6% rise in heart attacks and a surge in accidents. Energy savings, the supposed justification, are trivial, less than 1% by credible estimates. Arizona, free from this madness, prospers without it. Yet we persist, enslaved by our arrogance at tweaking the time improves life, just as we assume a nurse's duty roster proves her guilt. Cannabis, now fetishized as a panacea, deepens this delusion. Marketed as a remedy for ailments, including the insomnia sparked by daylight saving time disruptions. It is a wolf in sheep's clothing. A 2021 Lancet psychiatry study tied its regular use to heighten risks of psychosis and cognitive decline, particularly in young minds. Yet we embrace it, blinded by libertarian fantasies and progressive dogma, ignoring its potential to unhinge, perhaps even in the pressured wards where Letby worked. Like the flimsy case against her or the futile clock shifting cannabis reflects our refusal to face hard reality. Letby's plight, daylight saving, and cannabis are bound by a common thread, an unshakable faith in flawed systems and seductive narratives. We convict without proof, disrupt time without purpose, and normalize drugs without caution, all to avoid the discomfort of truth. This is our tragedy. A society that scorns reason for the false comfort of certainty. We must abolish daylight savings, reject the cannabis craze, and, most urgently, re-examine Letby's case with clear-eyed doubt. Only by dismantling these delusions can we escape the shadows we have cast, a darkness where innocence is damned, nature is deified, and minds are clouded by our own folly.
Incredible.
Bravo.
Well done,
Grot,
for writing that. Well, that was a really good impression as well.
Postback.
It's bulging, eh?
So, we've got a question here from James Cameron. Not sure if it's the famous film director or someone else, but how can we reverse the flight of wealth out of the country? It's all the millionaires leaving.
Tax them less. Well, I would say there are
two
things. The inheritance tax exemption that Rachel Reeves revoked, which means that if you are a high net worth individual in the UK and you are from somewhere else, you've got money elsewhere that has never even touched the UK, you still have to pay inheritance tax in the UK. I think that was more damaging and, you know, larger driver for all these millionaires leaving than even the abolition of the non-dom tax status.
Yeah, there were a few things. In fact, it kind of reminds me again of that, the India trade deal, right, with the national insurance tax break. So you had loads of Labour supporters obviously cheering on this deal and defending this tax break, who 6 months ago presumably were outraged at an Indian, specifically Rishi Sunak's wife, paying tax in India but not in the UK, which is exactly what this trade deal is going to do for loads of Indian workers. Anyway, just pointing out the hypocrisy there. There are loads of things. I mean, even the VAT-free shopping actually makes quite a big difference to some, well, more, that's more tourism, I guess, than actual residents. I think crime in London is a big problem. You know, I speak to people who, it's a combination of things. It's like the country is not worth living in anymore, combined with high taxes. And sunshine in Dubai, I guess. So yeah, you got rich people who are like not wearing their watch when they go out in London because they don't want to get it nicked. And after a while you think, well, I'm not going to get nicked in Dubai and I get a suntan, so I'll just go there and not pay any tax. I think Rachel Reeves is finding out quite quickly that there is not a whole lot of money left on the pavement that she can just pick up. I wrote about this actually the other day for The Critic. I think they came into government thinking that the Tories were deliberately not taxing the rich because all their mates are the rich. And now they're finding out that that's not the reason. They tax the rich as much as they could do. They just realise that if they tax them anymore, they'd bugger off. And now they're buggering off.
Well, a millionaire leaves the UK every 45 minutes.
Supposedly, yeah. I'm a little bit sceptical about these estimates. It's from some massive wealth fund, isn't it? The estimates about how many millionaires are leaving.
I definitely believe that there are. I mean, I have spoken to a couple of people that know certain millionaires that have definitely left the country.
But a millionaire would just be someone who sold their house in London.
Yeah.
Like a middle-class person who sold their house.
Actually not a very high bar anymore.
No, we've had a lot of inflation.
This is the most IEA conversation I think we've ever had. Bring me the tiny violin for the millionaires. No, I'm joking. But what else have we got here?
They're the wealth creators, Tom.
No, absolutely.
There would be no jobs.
They spend more as well, which means that you guys can have jobs.
Yes, trickle-down economics.
Okay, I should be grateful, ladies and gentlemen. This is an email from Neil. This is less of a question, more of, I think, a suggestion for the bands. Not sure if hazard warning lights on cars have been mentioned previously in things we should ban. They were invented so that if you broke down, the hazard warning lights would still work without ignition, thus warning other motorists to be careful. But they seem to be used solely for the purpose of four-wheel drive owners who can't park or can't be bothered to search for a space and feel entitled to block the road.
An interesting point.
The ultimate entitlement accessory. It goes on. These lights should be replaced with brightly coloured flags, which the drivers have to wave to alert the traffic. That would solve the problem.
Brightly coloured flags?
Yeah. Sort of semaphore like situation.
LGBT flag.
My wife,
it can be any flag you want. No, no. As long as you've got one.
When we're on the motorway as a family, whenever she always drives, she's a nervous backseat driver, so she tends to drive. And whenever anyone slows down at all ahead of her on the motorway, by which I just mean she sees anyone put the brake lights on, she reaches for the hazards to put them on, because she just thinks you should warn people behind you, like they can't see the brake lights themselves. Which I think is fair enough if you're coming up to a complete standstill.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes it can be useful. It's like, God damn it, slow down quickly. But she does it all the time, to the point where it's, I think, actually dangerous driving, because you can never find the bloody things, and she's just looking around while people are breaking ahead of her. She's just, look after yourself, you know?
Yeah.
But it's a good point. I hadn't thought about the fact that you could use your hazard lights when the engine's not on. That obviously is true. I mean, people have been doing this for a very long time, that's what I'll say. It's not a new thing, like people playing music loudly on the train and stuff. So, yes, I agree. You can't use it just to say, I'm parked on a double yellow line and that's all right because I've got my hazards on.
Do you like the flags idea particularly?
Not really.
No. Too much exercise. Too much effort.
It doesn't sound very practical.
I can't drive, so I have absolutely nothing to add to this conversation.
Yeah, no, me neither. So all of this is theoretical to me, largely speaking. While we're on the subject of banning things.
You are a dictator.
Reem, what would your ban be? I think you've been on the show enough times to go through a whole litany of things that irk you, but is there anything new you want to add to the list of things you would clamp down on?
There is. So I'm really, really late to the party on this, massively, and I recognise that because I remember seeing everybody on Twitter complain about this particular thing, this particular behaviour, and I thought, you know, you guys are all being massively dramatic about this. It isn't really that big of a deal. And then I was on a bus the other day, and it was somewhere around West London, and it was really, really packed, and the temperature must have been about 22 degrees, really hot. And I've seen four different people playing different music out loud. One of them, sorry, I think was scrolling on TikTok out loud. And I was just absolutely outraged. I just could not believe the absolute cheek of it. And see, nobody else seemed to really care.
Mm.
They just didn't seem bothered. It was absolutely fine. There was a lovely little old couple there, and they were just like, yeah, because they're so used to it. This is absolutely heinous, and it really upset me.
What were the old people listening to? They're blasting out about Frank Sinatra.
Yeah. No, but this
Glenn
is
Miller.
It.
Like.
They weren't all like 18. They were like 50.
Oh, really? Really?
Yeah, they were old. They were
what
not
kind
young.
Of music was it?
Well, one of... Well, it was like Bollywood music.
Ah.
It has gone up the age ranges, though, and across demographics, I've noticed. Like, it's That's not just shocking. The young people anymore, it's older people. There's no rhyme or reason.
Well, this is what happens if you take the bus.
The central line was down, so I had no choice. Right. I literally had
emergency.
No choice. Yeah, it was insane.
Can I add something to one of my previous nominations for this? The notorious wheelie suitcases, actually.
Yeah.
One of the many unpleasant features of the wheelie suitcase, which has really been irking me in the last couple of weeks, is when I'm sat on the train in one of the six-seater, you know, arrangements.
Yeah, spread out, feet on the seats.
Usually, yeah, usually it's just me to start with because I'm coming from a long way away. I'm sat by the window on the with the tiny little table in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
And then because I have to go via Gatwick, you get people coming on with wheelie suitcases. Now, I will, as I said in the past, I will turn a blind eye to people with a wheelie suitcase if they are going on a foreign holiday.
Yeah.
I'm not, you know, completely intolerant. I don't like it, but I can see a case for it. However, they case do have a suitcase for it. Yeah, that's what they should have, a suitcase for it. But they do have, every other carriage on Southern trains, they have a luggage rack, which people with these suitcases seem to completely ignore.
Yeah.
And I got to Gatwick the other day, coming up to London, and a couple of people looked like they were from maybe Colombia or something like that, and they got on with their big suitcases and just blocked me in. This is what they do. You get a couple, they go face to face, and they both have a suitcase, and they just block you in. And as it happened, I was going to have to go to the toilet at some point on this train. In fact, I was coming back from London, so I had a number of pints, right? And I knew at some point I was going to have to go to the toilet. And these people blocking me in was extremely annoying, because I knew at some point I would have to make a big song and dance about getting them out of the way. So I said, as they sat down, I said, you know, friendly-like, took my headphones out, said, luggage right there, if you want to use them. They go, no, okay. No, I'm not asking you.
You must listen to me.
Get put it on the luggage rack. You're blocking me in. Yeah. They've sat in two or three times just in the last fortnight.
Something's
where people
wrong.
Block me in. And
are they too afraid to be apart from their suitcases? Do they think someone's going to nick them or something?
Maybe.
I think that is part of it.
Because that is a bit of a flaw in the system. Rather than putting it up top, it's kind of slightly down the way from you. But still, just use it.
And if there aren't any seats in the... No, because if there aren't any seats in the middle, then your suitcase literally, I mean, 2-3 metres away from you, somebody will nick it. I'm actually kind of on their side, Chris.
Oh, give up.
Well, yeah, because literally you can get everything stolen.
Well, just with them wheels, you can make a quick
sit somewhere where you can see the luggage rack. I could see it from where I was.
You can see it get stolen.
Well, you just chase after them. I mean, it takes... These are big...
Chris, do you think...
These are big wheelie suitcases.
Somebody?
We don't need to just go stop thief. It's a big wheelie. It's not like a purse. You can just run off with it.
Have you ever been mugged in London?
Some white knight would say, oh, is that your bag? And he'd say, give it here, mate.
People aren't even emboldened enough to tell off people for playing music, you know, let alone chasing down thieves.
You've got way too much trust in
being a thief is surely worse than playing music.
Oh, no, that's true. Or is it?
Thieving wheelie suitcases is already illegal, whereas playing music will only be illegal under a Lib Dem government.
Yes, yeah. I think you're so wrong with this. You actually think that if somebody was stealing my suitcase, they would do anything about it?
Yeah.
I think you're completely wrong.
Well, you live in a rough part of London, probably. I'm talking about respectable people going back to Sussex.
There's nobody respectable left in London. They're all gone.
Yeah,
they're
I know.
Dubai.
I know. I'm not talking about those people. I'm talking about intercity travel.
People like you.
Yeah.
The respectable people.
Decent folk who still stand up for each other. It's a big society.
This is the hill I'm going to die on. There is absolutely no more respectable people in London. And nobody would try and help me if my suitcase was being stolen. No one would.
I hope you enjoyed that episode of Last Orders. If you're watching this on YouTube, make sure you subscribe and click the bell so that you never miss another Spiked video. If you're listening to this on your podcast app, make sure you subscribe there and leave us a glowing 5-star review. And if you'd like to get in touch with your questions or band suggestions, email us at lastorders@spiked-online.com.